Last Word on Today FM.
Let's turn to the last word of the environment. Sive O'Neill, a climate and environmental researcher and Irish Times contributor, is with us again this week. John Gibbons is away on holiday. The first thing I want to talk to you about, Sive, is what's known as car spreading, the bigger sizes of motor vehicles, and how this is impacting on safety on the roads, but also on something as simple as car parking spaces.
Thank you very much, Matt, and lovely to be with you. So I think anybody who's been paying attention to the kind of vehicles that we are seeing on our roads has noticed that the average car size has increased quite a bit, and the kind of saloon car that would have been typical 20 years ago is a rarity now. So there's a think tank, Transport and Environment, that have been worried about this and researching it for a long time, because not only do these larger cars weigh more, even if they're EVs, that means that there is a lot more embodied carbon, but they also represent an increased hazard. And that's because the bonnet height has increased from an average of about 77 centimetres up to about, I think it's up to now about 84. And they reckon that the average bonnet lip will be 92 centimetres off the ground. So, that would take it up to hip height for an adult. And the impact of that design change is very significant for road safety, because when a car strikes a pedestrian, if you have a low bonnet, this is all terrible, obviously, the person's legs will be hit and it may involve broken bones, but the car tends to push the bonnet design tends to push the pedestrian out of the way, whereas the SUV style with that very high bonnet means that the pedestrian is at risk of being flung forward, and that heightens the risk of head injury. And this isn't just speculation. Lots of research has found that there are more fatalities associated with collisions. So it doesn't necessarily change the number of collisions, but it changes the number of fatalities. And they reckon, that's T&E, that if cars continue to get bigger, there could be an additional, wait for this, 2,500 adults and 79 children killed over the next 15 years. So they're looking for legislation, essentially, to limit the size of cars and to stop the industry increasing the size as a way of extracting more profit per vehicle.
There's also the practical issue of on-street car parking spaces, and yes, also what happens in multi-storey car parks, because a lot of these were marked out for cars that are smaller than those that are common now.
I know, and a lot of those design standards, they're very routine. They're kind of standard designs that are applied everywhere in every type of every parking space should be more or less the same, so people don't have to make these numbers up. The architects, engineers use these kind of, standard designs. But if the vehicle manufacturers are designing cars that don't fit into them, are we supposed to go and redesign car parks to accommodate this? Or what's supposed to happen? And in fact, what is extraordinary, and, they've worked out, T&E, that in Dublin, the extra size of these cars means that they're not fitting in to the parking spaces, and that up to 14% of on-street parking spaces will essentially be unusable if the cars are too big to fit in between the existing lines. And that would lead to the loss of 2,700 spaces, which is incredible. Like, why are we letting this happen? It's such an incredible waste of space. That's not accommodating more cars. That's just one car taking up two spaces.
Sive, there is one listener who says that whatever about the increased dangers to pedestrians and others, that bigger cars now are safer for the occupants, that you maybe need to take into account that people have their lives saved by being in better built cars than would have been the case in previous generations.
Well, in that case, we should all drive around in tanks. If you think it through, that's quite illogical, because you're putting one road user at the mercy of another. So when we think about roads, we need to think about the safety of everybody. So you can't have people driving down in tanks, because that would put other road users at danger. But what's happening is you have a kind of market-driven evolution of car design that is pitting car drivers in these large, safer vehicles against vulnerable road users. I think we should interrogate that, and we should think about what that means. Why is having smaller cars that go at lower speed not an option in this conversation, you know, or in this policy arena? It would be better for the environment, be better for people, and it would be safer. The best thing we can do for safety, by the way, is not to get into bigger, heavier cars, but to drive more slowly.
Okay, let's move it on. And hopefully the disaster in Venezuela from the earthquake is not as bad as has been speculated, but it does seem that we have at least 100,000 people missing at present. And what happens in earthquakes is the bad information tends to take time to get out. But there's a review suggesting, and this does seem a little bit hard to understand, that climate change is leading to an increase in earthquakes. How could it possibly do so?
I know the science behind this is fascinating. So on top of everything else that we have to worry about, global warming is going to accelerate earthquakes. And that's because of the weather, way that weather conditions can influence seismic activity. Now, what are we talking about here? Massive storms, intense rainfall, and I suppose the relationship between water bodies and the land. Now, I'm not a geographer. I'm not a seismologist. I find this fascinating and hard to grasp as well. But the reality is that all of the systems that we depend on for our survival on planet Earth are all connected. You know, the seismic activity, which incidentally is quite a chaotic thing, which is like, even though they have all this incredible measurement and science behind measuring earthquakes and danger zones and so on, they still can't really predict when an earthquake can happen. It's a mathematically very chaotic process. There's a lot of randomness involved. And so weather is part of that randomness that comes into it. So it is extraordinary. I had not realized it, for example, that in 2020, when France was hit by Storm Alex, it generated a huge amount of rain in the southeast of the country. And over the next 100 days, there were 188 earthquakes. Now, these wouldn't necessarily have been noticed by the public, but they were picked up by the measurements. So for earthquake-prone areas, thankfully, we're not one of them, that suggests that that's another reason to be concerned about climate change and another reason to take action, as if you didn't have enough.
Okay, and then you've also been writing about how the Earth's vital signs are flashing red and crying out for attention. What do you mean by this?
Yes, so I came across, and they publish it very regularly, actually, the Copernicus information for, I think it was May, May's data I was writing about, and they produced also an annual report that looks at indicators of global climate change. So when we talk about climate change, we're used to talking about it in terms of temperature increase. That's where that 1.5 degree temperature guardrail came from, where the scientists said that if we tip over that point, we're heading into dangerous territory for climate impacts. But the increase in surface temperature is actually only one of a number of indicators. And the one that I was writing about in today's Irish Times is basically the Earth's energy imbalance. So surface temperature increase is only one way that the planet is heating up. And most of the extra heat, the extra energy, the thermal energy, as a result of climate change and the trapping effect of those greenhouse gases, is being absorbed by our oceans. And that's 90% of the ocean. So what the report that I was writing about found was that the long-term energy imbalance has risen significantly. And I won't read out the data because it's a little bit complicated.
Yeah, but what does that actually mean, though? What is the implication of it?
The implication of it is, as I understand it, is that, right, so the laws of physics demand that the energy that's being trapped in the oceans has to be released. The Earth has to go into equilibrium, essentially. And there's no magic technology for making that vanish, to make it go away or to push that energy out into space. So the reality is that we're locking in more global warming in the oceans. Eventually, that heat is going to come back out. And it's not just heat. It'll come by way of extreme precipitation and weather effects. So what I'm saying is that even as we look at the alarming figures, that global greenhouse gas emissions have not yet started to decline, we are in a situation where we could have locked in more global warming than we are seeing at the moment. And it's in the oceans, and it's going to have an impact over time. And that is consistent with all the models. The scientists in Copernicus, they have a comprehensive monitoring and observation program. So every month they're looking at, you know, what happened this month? Is it average weather? Are there different things happening that are consistent with climate change? And they're finding that the anomalies we saw in May, which doesn't even cover what's happened in the last month, obviously, is consistent with the predictions of the climate models. We're looking at average temperatures in some places soaring 10 degrees above average. And that's not normal. A heat wave is one thing, but when you have temperatures 10 degrees in excess of the average. And another thing that's worrying and is not normal is to have these prolonged heat waves early in the summer. Typically in Europe, you see them later in the summer, in July and August. To be experiencing heat waves in May is very unusual. So all of this means that climate change is happening. It's not a theory. It's not speculation. The Earth monitoring that's being done by scientists is telling us that it's already happening and that we can expect things to get much worse because of that locked-in warming in the oceans. What it means for Ireland, it's hard to say because we could be looking at collapse of the AMOC, the Atlantic currents, essentially, the huge currents that keep our climate cool. But it also could mean that we start to experience a lot more heat waves and extreme weather, although maybe not to the same extent as the continent or even southern England. Very good news, I'm afraid.
No, very briefly, just to finish, the Electoral Commission has found that the total carbon cost of posters in a general election is the equivalent of a full commercial plane making two return flights from Dublin to New York. Is that a sufficient reason to ban election posters?
Well, I have to say guilty, because I ran in the 2024 general election and I have posters still sitting in my garden. And I couldn't believe the carbon cost was that much. But when you think about all the candidates and, you know, printing companies have got very efficient at printing large quantities of them for parties, and it's a huge amount. So we absolutely have to do something about it. And I think it'll be very popular with the public, because the public are always complaining about posters. They might like one or two to remind them of who the candidates are, but the proliferation of posters during elections is not something that the public asks for. And of course, we're exempt from the litter laws during that period. We just have to get them down by a certain deadline. So I would certainly welcome this. And I think that is a very sobering figure, to see that amount of carbon that's not necessarily serving the public interest in the way that we think it is. There are other ways in this day and age that we can get our mugs out there in front of the public.
Sive O'Neill, thank you for joining us. Climate and environmental researcher, contributor to the Irish Times.
The Last Word on Today FM.